Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Today's guest, Jeff Chang, authored the award-winning book Can't Stop, Won't Stop, A History of the Hip-Hop Generation. Following up on how the rise of hip-hop predicted today's cultural politics, Jeff Chang brings us a new book focusing on how Americans' views of race have changed over the past 50 years. It's a massive undertaking, and he does it through the lens of artists, comic strips, contemporary art, campus protests, and corporate marketing campaigns. In the introduction, he writes, quote, "The book begins at the end of the civil rights movement when the Republican Southern strategy locked into place a politics of racial distancing. It discusses the rise and fall of the multiculturalism movement. It revisits the claims for representation and recognition, the debates about the nature and future of American culture, and it examines how multiculturalism's animating ideas were acknowledged, adopted, and diverted to the market and the state." The book then moves on to look at how demographic changes have impacted American arts, politics, and electoral politics. And it asks why, after colorization, has racial and cultural inequality remained largely unseen and undiscussed? Jeff Chang is executive director of the Institute for Diversity in the Arts at Stanford and author of Who We Be, The Colorization of America. And Jeff joins me in studio. Hi, Jeff. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Rose. Great to be back.
It's great to have you. It's been a while.
Yeah.
So when we got this book, and you know, you're writing about how things have changed over the past 50 years, specifically Americans' perceptions of race, I thought, wow, this is a massive undertaking. Why did you decide to focus on five decades?
I can't do things small. I was really interested, I think, in tracing the arc of what we've seen, you know, over the last five decades, largely because, you know, Can't Stop, Won't Stop had, even in that book, sort of a 30-year, 40-year sweep as well. And I was interested in kind of taking a step back from that and looking at how cultural desegregation, the kind of cultural desegregation that we see now in the media, came to be.
Hmm. I like the metaphor of the ocean. Mm. You write about this in the preface, and I'm assuming that these are the main questions that came up for you. How has the national culture changed over the past half century that we could elect a black president? And just as important, how has it not changed? The answers you invite us to imagine might resemble a wave, a discrete event that is the culmination of a global process of forces generated in the Arctic or the Antarctic, rolling from the bottom of the ocean for hundreds of miles until they gather to hit shallow reefs.
I was playing with the idea that politics is hard.
Yeah.
And that culture is soft, right? Mm. Which is the language I think that people use when talking about global diplomacy. It's also the kind of way that we see change. I mean, politics is seen as the actual change, and it takes place in events. A judicial decision, an election, a meeting, a protest, a demonstration, a physical event that is captured in time. But culture is a type of thing that you can measure in processes. It's the interaction that we're having now. It's all of the stuff that's happening on Twitter or Facebook, even as we're talking. It's the accumulation of all of these different types of things that move our minds and help us to get in a space where we can imagine what change actually looks like. So I wanted to capture that. And I wanted to, in that sense, put artists and folks who work in the culture at the center of change making.
Why did you want to focus on artists?
Because I think that they've been undersung in terms of the impact that they've been having on the way that we actually see things. If you look at, for instance, the civil rights movement and the victories of the civil rights era, right? We have these massive pieces of legislation that are passed, the Voting Rights Act, the Civil Rights Act, the Immigration and Nationality Act that passed in the mid-60s. But none of these pieces of legislation can tell us how we should be living together. And for that, we have to turn to the culture. And so what you see happening then is the rise of artists imagining what a post-segregated future can look like. And in a lot of ways, those artists were based here in the Bay Area. So I talk a lot about Maury Turner, the first syndicated African-American cartoonist who was my neighbor in South Berkeley. and how he had a cartoon called Wee Pals that came out just months before the Voting Rights Act was passed, before Watts happened, just weeks before Malcolm X was assassinated. And it was the first cartoon strip that actually put a cast of multiracial kids working things out on a day-to-day type of basis. It was powerful. I think anybody in the Bay Area who's of a certain age will start getting choked up a little bit thinking about this cartoon. I know I grew up in Hawaii, and I became a fan of Wee Pals very young.
And Maury Turner was inspired by Charles Schulz. How did the public respond to Maury Turner's comic strip, again, the first syndicated African-American cartoonist?
Well, Maury's strip was, it came out in less than 10 newspapers when it started. But after Martin Luther King passed away or was assassinated, let's be specific.
Yeah.
After Martin Luther King was assassinated, suddenly his range rose to 100 newspapers overnight. And Maury always felt kind of weird about that. He felt that in a weird way that maybe guilt had actually allowed his comic strip to expand. But the reality of it is that it became mainstream at that particular point. There was a cartoon show around it. There were records. There were lunch boxes. There were all kinds of things that kind of came out about it. And it was a real intervention, I think, into the culture at that particular point, trying to imagine what a post-segregated future could look like.
Hmm. And also, you say that the one thing Maury also did is look at sort of how we can choose to live together,
mm-hmm.
right? And talk about the significance of that.
Well, he always said that kids could say things that you couldn't allow adults to get away with. And so I have a bunch of illustrations in the book of his comic strips where he does show, these kids talking about black power, red power, yellow power. And then, the Jewish kid says bagel power, and they go bagel power. But, these were ideas that were scary at the time. They were seen as divisive, as harming this notion that everybody should be assimilating into one America. And he was trying to say, no, actually, there are all these different ways that people understand being American.
And so in addition to someone like Maury and other artists focusing on a new vision of how we can live together, they also focused it on how we see each other.
Mm-hmm.
And that's another really important thing, something that, politics really can't do, or at least not a very good job of doing something like that.
No, and so the sort of central organizing metaphor of the book is seeing, mm-hmm. how we see race and how that's changed and how it hasn't changed. And the notion is that race is not biological. It's a construct, and it emerges from the gap between appearance and the perception of difference. And then it's about how we attach different types of things to those differences. And so, there's one school of thought that is pretty much dominant, I think, in U.S. society, which is that we should ignore the difference, that we shouldn't talk about the difference. Because in the past, when people have talked about difference, they've assigned ideas of superiority and inferiority to that difference. But the reality is that in order to undo the effects of that past, of these notions of slavery and freedom, of containment and tolerance, that we have to actually talk about difference, and that we have to surface it and talk about it openly. And that's one of the things that I'm trying to get at. The reason we don't have a race conversation is because so many of us try to presume that we should not talk about race at all.
Well, what do you think of the conversation that we are having right now? Because we've had many shows on this issue, but when you just think of what's out there, what a lot of people are seeing, I mean, Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow, is getting a lot of attention. On NPR, you hear a lot of stories about how parents talk to their children about race, kids of color especially.
Mm-hmm.
You're hearing a lot of Republicans talk about the prison system and why are so many blacks in prison? And so there's a lot of things sort of bubbling up. And I wonder, as someone who's spent so much time focused on these issues specifically, do you see this as progress?
Well, so there's two things that are happening at the same time. On the one hand, those conversations are happening, yes. On the other hand, when parents talk to their children, there's a huge gap in how they talk to their children about race. So there was a study that was done of 19,000 sets of parents. And what they looked at is these parents of young children, do they talk to their kids about race or do they not? And 75% of white parents don't. And parents of kids of color, so we could be talking about mixed race kids here as well, 2 to 5 times more likely to do so. And I put that together with this 2014 survey that came out earlier this year, MTV and David Binder did, that look at millennials and their ideas about race. And overwhelmingly, millennials feel like, on the one hand, we should be shooting for colorblindness as an ideal. And on the other hand, we should be respecting each other for their difference and diversity, you know, uphold diversity. These are contradictory kinds of positions. And in fact, the entire era of the culture wars, these were opposite positions. And we're talking about the years from 1980 through actually now, the sort of resurgent culture wars that we're seeing during the Obama era. So they asked young people, do you feel comfortable talking about racial bias, let alone inequality and inequity? We're talking about just racial bias here. 80% said no. And it's because we don't have the language. So what we're seeing on the one hand is this increase in terms of folks pushing, like Michelle Alexander, pushing the sort of, you know, the envelope forward in relating race to our, you know, bankrupt policies of incarceration and justice, criminal justice. And on the other hand, we're seeing a lack of being able to have that discussion within the home. And so on the campuses now, and I work at Stanford University, and so I've seen what's been happening across the U.S., you know, there's been a lot of discussion coming back around the discussions that aren't happening about race, despite now 2 decades, really, of diversity training and, you know, sensitivity and all that kind of stuff. And you just wonder, wow, you know, 25 years after I was out there as a student fighting for all these kinds of things, and students are still feeling like they have to fight for it now, it's disheartening.
What do you hear from your students at Stanford?
Well, there's a need to be able to have these discussions, and it gets framed around this language of microaggressions, which is the notion of these little things that people say or do that remind you of what your place is within the hierarchy. So there's a lot of discussion about how, you know, to make those conversations meaningful, because now, you know, if you come in as a student, there's orientation processes that talk about honoring diversity and being able to take us to a place where, you know, people are respectful of each other. So multiculturalism has been really successful in resetting the bounds of civility, right? Multiculturalism has taught us what not to say to each other. But it hasn't taught us, Rose, like, what to say next to each other. And I think that that's exactly where we're at this particular point in history.
So do you think that that is the one issue that we need to focus on at this moment in history? Where is this going?
I don't think it's the only issue. But
one of the ones that you've spent a lot of time thinking about.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. I think that in order for us to get to, you know, everybody's talking about 2042, right, when we become a quote-unquote majority-minority, you know, country, which I don't really even know what majority minority means.
Yeah.
But what I do know is this, is if we're all minorities, we still have to figure out a way to become a majority or forge majorities, right? And in order to do that, we've got to figure out a way to talk to each other. And so these conversations kind of need to be had. I told my students the other week, you know, when we get to 2042, they're going to be my age. So, which is pretty old. So,
no, it's not. We're probably the same age. It's
okay.
Not old.
Well, yeah. Okay. So we can say that to each other. But what I'm trying to tell them is, you need to talk about this now. You guys need to be figuring this stuff out now, because it's going to be real. It's going to be really real.
Jeff Chang is executive director of the Institute for Diversity in the Arts at Stanford and author of the new book, Who We Be, The Colorization of America. And Jeff looks at how Americans' perceptions of race have changed over the last 50 years, mostly through the lens of artists. And Jeff will be speaking on November 10th at the First Congregational Church in Oakland at 7:30. And then on November 11th at City College Chinatown campus in San Francisco. Francisco at 7 o'clock, and you can find information at yourcallradio.org. And we'd love to hear from you on this issue. We're continuing, really, our ongoing discussions on race and how we talk to each other and where we are today. What are your thoughts on Jeff's main argument? We just don't have the language to move forward. How do you think we should be talking about these issues? Do you think that the conversations that you're hearing in the national conversation have a lot of substance? And then how do you think Americans' perceptions of race have really changed over the last 50 years? What stands out for you specifically? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. If you have personal experiences you'd like to share. Also, it's so interesting to think about the differences between politics and culture, because I really would like to talk to you about this, Jeff, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on this too. And you can email us feedback at yourcallradio.org. You can also leave a web comment at yourcallradio.org. Senator Mary Landrieu of Louisiana told Chuck Todd of NBC's Meet the Press, quote, "To be very honest, the South has not always been the friendliest place for African Americans. It's been a difficult time for the president to present himself in a very positive light as a leader. It's not always been a good place for women to present ourselves. It's more of a conservative place, so we've had to work a little bit harder on that." Now, the sentence that's getting the most attention is, "To be very, very honest with you, the South has not always been the friendliest place for African Americans." Well, a lot of us say, well,
exactly.
But she's getting slammed for this comment.
Mm-hmm.
So what are your thoughts on that? Because as much as that's politics, that's also culture.
Yeah. In every generation, there's a sort of a need to figure out how to have this discussion around race. And I think that the current discussion is pushing us back towards colorblindness. And I wanted to say that, you know, in the 1980s, the right push colorblindness as a way of trying to fight against racial justice policies, specifically around stuff like affirmative action and other sort of, you know, post-civil rights types of policies that were meant to foster racial equality and cultural equity. And so what's interesting now is that anybody with any kind of understanding of history would totally understand that that was true. I mean, it's a truthful statement. Slavery, yeah, slavery definitely would count, I think, under Mary Landrieu's definition of difficult time, and the sort of history of disenfranchising African Americans in the South, all the way on through the development of the Southern Strategy, by which the Republicans were able to, you know, take away power from the Democrats in the South, and then maintain it again during the 80s by making calls, explicit calls to race. All of that stuff is out there. And so there's a political effort to try to hide that, right? And so we have amnesia in every generation around this. And part of, you know, the reason for writing the book really was to try to get back at some of these stories. The multiculturalism movement isn't anything that's really talked about. It's almost just understood as a fait accompli. It's like we woke up one day in the 90s and suddenly there are all kinds of folks of color on TV. It's like ABC's fall TV lineup, right? Just happened. Like there was no sort of push, you know, and there hasn't been this kind of push that has been happening for representation, you know, for hundreds of years. So I think it's really interesting that it should be happening now again.
Yeah. Talk a little bit about Ishmael Reed and his proposal back in
1975.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that was a radical, right, to think of America as a sort of a multicultural country. That was radical back then.
Absolutely.
Whereas today we sort of take it for granted.
We take it for granted, right.
Right.
And the idea, and it really, you know, it's happening in New York, it's happening in Chicago, it's happening in Los Angeles, but the idea really takes deepest root here in the Bay Area, out of the rise of feminism and then feminists of color in the Bay Area, and also out of the rise of the Third World Strike at San Francisco State and the sort of Third World Liberation Movement that rises out of that. And so you know, you push on from when this is beginning to happen in the late 60s into the 70s, and suddenly you have this counterculture of writers and artists who are saying, no, actually, America is not a monoculture. It's a multiculture. And this word in of itself was considered radical at the time. There was a hyphen between multi and culture because people couldn't imagine a U.S. that in which all these different kinds of cultures had informed it. But the multiculturalists like Ishmael Reed, like Ntozake Shange, like Jessica Hagedorn, like Janice Mirakatani, like a whole bunch of other folks were saying, actually, it's always been that way. We've always been a multiculture. Let's tell the stories of underrepresented folks, and let's sort of understand the U.S. in a completely different way. And this then takes hold in the 80s as demographics shift and the culture wars begin.
Let's take a few callers before we go to break. Let's hear from Matt in San Francisco. Hi, Matt. Welcome to the show.
Hi. It's actually Dana, and I appreciate the wave reference, Jeff. It shows your Hawaii stuff. we know one another. My dad, I think, was one of your math teachers.
Oh.
And I have a question for you regarding your having grown up in Hawaii in the hothouse of race and cultural interactions that the 70s and 80s were with Rep Redlinger, Annie Bumatai, and all of those Boy Dog recordings.
Yeah.
And how overt race was part of what we grew up with. And I know that when I got to the mainland, I was really shocked at how poor race relations and even straight queer relations were as compared to what I knew growing up in Hawaii. And I'd love it if you could speak to that. And I'll try and swing by the Chinatown thing. We haven't seen each other, you know, since we graduated high school.
Awesome. Thanks so much for that. Yeah, I grew up in Honolulu, Hawaii, and, you know, people talk about changing demographics, and I just say, hey, I can talk about Chang demographics. And you can already hear a little bit of the pigeon creeping into my voice, I guess. You know, the family that I come from is several generations in Hawaii, and we, you know, by now have intermarried with pretty much every race that there is to be found. And it doesn't minimize the differences in equality and background that folks come from. And there's a different kind of racial hierarchy in Hawaii that is often glossed over. But folks have also worked very hard at trying to figure out ways to live together, too. And so the metaphor of my family pretty much is what kind of, I think, drove me in some ways to understand how to approach the question of race when I came up here to go to Cal during the 80s, during the height of the culture wars, really.
Mm. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, thank you for calling. And actually, we'll get calls right after the break. I'm speaking today with Jeff Chang. He authored the award-winning book Can't Stop, Won't Stop, A History of the Hip-Hop Generation. And following up on how the rise of hip-hop predicted today's cultural politics, Jeff brings us a new book focusing on how Americans' views of race have changed over the past 50 years. And he does it through the lens of artists. And if you'd like to join us, we'd love to hear from you. If you remember Maury Turner, Jeff talked about Maury earlier, the first syndicated African-American cartoonist who really focused on how we can choose to live together. If you remember that comic strip, we'd love to hear from you. And then also, where do you think we should go from here? What kind of language should we use? And I'd love to ask you that, Jeff. So you say that we talk about racial bias, but we don't know how to really talk about it. And how do we use the language to talk about where we're heading? 2042, expected to become a majority minority. We'll be back after this.
You're listening to Rose Aguilar and Your Call on Local Public Radio, KALW. To join today's conversation, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. Toll free, 866-798-TALK. If you'd prefer to write rather than call, the email address is feedback@yourcallradio.org. Coming up at 11 on World Have Your Say from the BBC, is space tourism a dangerous vanity project? We'll report on the latest investigation of a crash last week, Richard Branson's Virgin Galactic test flight. Also, the story of Brittany Maynard and dying with dignity. That's coming up at 11 on World Have Your Say here on Local Public Radio.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will have a conversation with the Black Panthers co-founder Bobby Seale and the artistic director of Party People. It's a new play at Berkeley Rep. It reflects on the history of the Black Panther Party and the Young Lords, a Puerto Rican immigrant rights movement that called for independence. So what can we learn from their radical histories, and what is considered a revolutionary act today? Be sure to check out that play. It's a really good play. And we'll probably be kind of continuing today's conversation tomorrow. And then on Wednesday, we will do a post-election show. We will bring you the results, and we'd love to hear from you what's happening in your area, what passed, what didn't pass. Be sure to tune in for a post-election show on Wednesday. And if you have a guest idea or a show idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, I am speaking with Jeff Chang, Executive Director of the Institute for Diversity in the Arts at Stanford and author of the new book, Who We Be, The Colorization of America. Jeff looks at how our perceptions of race have changed over the last 50 years, mostly through the lens of artists. And Jeff will be speaking on November 10th at the First Congregational Church in Oakland at 7:30, and then again on November 11th at the City College Chinatown campus in San Francisco at 7 o'clock. And you can find information at yourcallradio.org. And you can join us at 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. You can also leave a comment online, yourcallradio.org. And so we'll get to callers in a minute. But earlier you said we really don't have the language to take us to 2042 when we're expected to become a majority minority, whatever that means. But we were talking before the break. I mean, it's so rare to even meet someone nowadays who's maybe under 40, who's maybe half and half. I mean, well, that's not true. But let's say under 20, who's half and half. It's just so interesting how it's changing so quickly.
Yeah, I think that the.
Can we?
Hello.
Go ahead, Jeff. Can you hear Jeff?
Yeah.
There we go. Okay, go ahead.
I think that the reality is that yes, demographics are changing incredibly quickly. I think that part of the discussion has to be about privilege, what it means to have privilege, and that, you know, goes for whites. It also goes for Asians and Latinos as well. I think that there's a really interesting way in which the notion of being mixed race challenges the way that we understand these old paradigms of race and the old sort of categories of race. But at the same time, there's a way in which it's used as a way to reinforce anti-black racism, to sort of wipe away different kinds of discussions that we need to be having about inequality and inequity in this country. And so there's a way in which we need to actually have those conversations in a much more nuanced kind of way than we're able to right now.
It's also interesting to look at identity and how people identify.
Mm-hmm.
And that's challenging for a lot of people.
Right. And I think that that's part of what's happening here in the book. And it's contradictory. You know, there's a chapter, for instance, on the so-called post-Black artists and the post-Chicano artists, post-Latino, post-Asian American generation of artists. And a lot of those artists would sound, I think, to somebody who was kind of coming up in the 60s, 70s, or 80s, like sellouts, like, oh, you just want to pretend that you don't have any kind of background here. You're a self-hater in a way, right? But really, I think it's in some respects a way of trying to imagine what it means to represent and respect the diversity of even people in all of these different types of groups. And so identity becomes much, much more complicated than we thought about it in the past as well.
Right. And also, because you did so much research and you are afraid that we're losing a lot of history on this issue, I do want to ask you about what happened at the Whitney Museum in 1993. It was a biennial show. It was a kind of a pivotal moment, the, quote, fall of multiculturalism. And at the museum, they handed out, they were tags.
They were museum tags,
museum
yeah.
Museum tags given to visitors that said, quote, I can't imagine ever wanting to be white.
Right. And this caused a huge controversy, you know, for
for a lot of folks in the elite, this was a direct challenge to the notion of America being one way. And this was such thought to be such a transgression that the elite almost as a united front came down and basically declared identity and multiculturalism dead. And it's had a long-term impact. If you're an art school student now, you might still be experiencing this. The notion of identity is not thought of as something that you should be including in your art if it's going to be about race. Gender and even sexuality is different now than it used to be. But identity is a bad word.
What went on behind the scenes? How were they able to hand out tags that said, I can't imagine ever wanting to be white?
Well, the context is that the multiculturalism movement by now had become something that had broken through in a lot of respects. There were culture wars that were happening on the campuses, Stanford University, UC Berkeley, fights over trying to diversify the faculty, diversify the curriculum, and a backlash as well, organizing out of what was then called Cal State Hayward, the National Association of Scholars, who were talking about these tenured radicals, quote unquote, with their quote unquote oppression studies and indoctrinating these students quote unquote political correctness. And so all of this stuff is raging at the same time that all of these artists are beginning to really make these loud and proud kinds of works of art that really address questions of race and identity head on. And so the curators of that show thought, this is what we have to represent. We do this biennial every 2 years. It represents what's happening in American art. This is what's happening in American art. And they decided to go all in on it. And so so curators like the great Thelma Golden and Elizabeth Sussman and John Hanhart and others are putting together this show that reflects that. And the elite doesn't receive it very well.
Has any other contemporary art showcase ever been as diverse or challenging?
This past year, there was a controversy in the biennial over a white man, Joe Scanlon, who had done a work of art under a black woman's name. And the kind of questions that rose. And there was a collective of African-American women and men, queer and straight, who were trying to raise the point that, hey, this guy Joe gets in to this, and yet representation is not still all that great for artists of color. Let's actually have a conversation about this. So you can see that the fallout is still kind of raging. What is it now? 21 years after. It's a long time. Yeah.
Jeff Chang is author of Who We Be, The Colorization of America. He's also executive director of the Institute for Diversity in the Arts at Stanford. And let's hear from Suzanne in Boulder Creek. Hi, Suzanne. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. The guest mentioned at the beginning of your talk that a lot of legislation was passed in the United States, but that it was... It really didn't, you know, teach people how to live, or, you know, people didn't know how to change in spite of the legislation. And I just wondered if you could expand on that, because the Civil Rights Act of 1964 outlawed discrimination based on race, color, and religion, et cetera. And it outlawed racial segregation. And piece of legislation that invites the country to learn how to not live in a segregated way, or in a positive phrasing, that teaches us all how to, or opens the discussion and the action of living together without segregation. It seemed to me for you to not recognize that seems kind of curious.
Yeah, I think you might have been misinterpreting me a little bit. I agree with the caller in that the legislative changes were able to dismantle these longstanding structures of legal segregation. But they don't necessarily tell you how to get along with your neighbor. And that's not the place of legislation. And so what I guess I'm trying to say is there are limits to what politics can do. Politics in terms of legislative politics, politics in terms of judicial politics. We can go back to the Brown versus Board of Education decision and what that did to strike down segregation and begin the process of desegregating the schools, which are now resegregated, are resegregating at a high rate. My aim in this book was to try to look at the paradox that we have here, which is that we have, you can turn on the TV and you can see all the rainbow country that we have playing and laughing and buying things together. And yet we can still have a Trayvon Martin incident. We could still have a Ferguson. We can still have these massively, wildly disparate rates of incarceration. We can still have these growing gaps in wealth and income and home ownership and educational attainment, and still have these gaps in talking about race. And I wanted to ask, what is it that we need to do in order to close those gaps?
All right. Thank you for the call. Let's go next to Joseph in Berkeley. Hi, Joseph.
Yes, good morning. A lot of what Jeff has been talking about this morning leads up to the issue of so-called identity politics, or the criticism of so-called identity politics. And I just want to say, in an article, in the comments section of an article that I wrote called On Malik Rahim, Malik, M-A-L-I-K, Rahim, R-A-H-I-M, On Malik Rahim, in the comments section, I engaged in a lengthy discussion and debate about this issue of identity politics. But I wanted to ask Jeff about, this issue, because it's been criticized as that of primarily people of color, has been criticized as separatist and divisive to the goal of a so-called post-racial society. Mm. And it's also often been criticized by people who call themselves Marxists as divisive and separatist and destructive of the goal of a so-called classless society. This is criticism on the liberal end that has been, sort of championed by Todd Gitlin. Our criticism actually started by conservatives. Ironically, white male identity politics is barely even a concept, because they are viewed, of course, as the norm and the standard. And Jewish identity politics, especially in the form of racism, which is written about by the author Gilad Atzmon in his book The Wandering Who, is generally not even acknowledged. So in addition to people who call themselves Marxists liking to say it's all class and not race and wanting to ignore race, this term, I believe, has been used to belittle and minimize the racial critiques of American society, and to actually try to avoid discussion about the centrality of race in society. But I'm wondering how Jeff views it as an Asian American.
You know, that's a fantastic question. I do write about this a lot in the book. I was one of the co-founding editors of Color Lines magazine, now colorlines.com. And in large part, the impetus to do Color Lines was, at that time, progressive magazines such as Mother Jones were saying that we needed to run away from identity politics, that this was something that was dividing the movement. This is at the sort of low ebb, I think, of progressive or what folks felt like was a low ebb of progressive politics, and people started circling their wagons and training their guns on each other and shooting each other. It's really interesting to kind of hear from Anne Friedman said this. She said maybe all politics is identity politics.
And Anne Friedman.
Anne Friedman, the writer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She writes for a lot of progressive magazines.
Of progressive magazines has said that. And, if we really kind of get down to it, it's really about the intersection of all these different types of things. It is about class, and it's also about race, and it's also about gender, and it's also about sexuality. It's also about all these other types of things that intervene. It's about all the identities together. If we're to build a new majority, we've got to figure out our way through those, not by belittling each other's identities where they enter the movement, right? Because identity is how people enter the movement. It's how people come to see themselves as part of a movement for social change. They identify with it through some way, shape, or form. Not by belittling it do we move forward, but by figuring out ways that we can intersect and find commonalities and move forward. So the book is really about trying to find common meaning. And that's not just in our movements, but really for all of our society.
Thank you for the call, Joseph. I'm speaking today with Jeff Chang, author of the new book, Who We Be, The Colorization of America. Jeff looks at how Americans' perceptions of race have changed over the past 50 years through the lens of artists, and then looks at where we're going. By 2042, the U.S. is expected to become a majority minority. Jeff says we really don't have the language to talk to each other as we race toward 2042. So what are your thoughts on that? And if you are an artist, how do you deal with these issues and express yourself when it comes to issues like race and class? And if there was an artist that really stood out for you, I actually have an email about Maury. If an artist stood out for you over the years and really grabbed your attention and maybe made you understand an issue better, or if you'd like to talk about it, we'd love to hear from you. These are big issues, right, Jeff? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's hear next from William in Belvedere. Hi, William.
Thank you very much. I live in a community that's less 0.1% Afro-American by the census. And the school district, which is shared with Tiburon, the demographics are less than 1% of black students. And I would like the guest perspective on, even though there can be a lot of talk about racial equality and we're all equal, etc., how does that impact the white students in a school district where, as I say, there's less than 1% blacks?
That's a great question. You know, one of the interesting statistics that I came upon when I was doing research for the book was that the Bay Area, in fact, has one of the most segregated public school populations in the state of California, which would put that up there nationally as well. It was shocking to me, because this is the birthplace of, again, all of these movements, all of these liberation movements. It's the birthplace of multiculturalism. And yet we still have a sort of market-driven housing patterns that allow for this massive segregation. And we also have white flight from the public schools, except in Berkeley, which has maintained its commitment to the desegregation orders and the consent decrees and has a model program. That's a lot of the reason I live in Berkeley. But I think that this is exactly the question. What the caller is asking about is a sort of smaller illustration of what's happening throughout the country, that white flight continues, and that even in terms of the conversations that we're having, like after Ferguson, there was a poll that was done, Times CBS poll, that looked at how people felt about what was happening in Ferguson, asked two questions. The first question was, do you think that the events in Ferguson are raising important issues of race that need to be discussed? The second question was, is this forcing race to be too much part of the discussion? Are we paying too much attention to race? And what you found was this huge divide that blacks felt overwhelmingly that it raised issues that needed to be discussed. And on the other hand, a plurality, not a majority, but a plurality of whites said it's drawing too much attention to race. Mm. And so these are the kinds of these are the difficulties that we have in being able to have this discussion about race. And when we kind of go back to, I think, how each generation is becoming socialized, and we look at the facts of resegregation on the ground as they are, it's pretty clear to me that we're recreating a lot of the stuff that we had 50 years ago. I think that that's the kind of stuff that we need to be looking at addressing in public policy. But it starts with having this conversation within the culture about how we are really going to be able to live together moving towards 2042.
All right. Well, thank you for calling in, William. Jeff Chang is author of the new book, Who We Be, The Colorization of America. He's executive director of the Institute for Diversity in the Arts at Stanford. How do you think Americans' perceptions of race have changed over the past 50 years? And if you'd like to join us, we have one line open at 866-798-8255, or you can email feedback at yourcallradio.org. Ray writes in, I live in Berkeley. I've been told that Maury Turner once lived in my house. I'd love to find out if this is true. But in any case, I'm really enjoying the program. If Jeff Chang can give me any hints on where to research Maury's life history, I would be grateful. Do you know if Maury, I don't know if Ray wants me to say his address on the air, but maybe I'll tell you after.
Yeah. Tell me. Yeah, let's get your address afterwards. Yeah. We might be neighbors, actually.
But do you have any? Where should he go to read more about Maury?
Oh, there's a lot of great stuff in the Berkeley Library. Maury had a number of paperbacks that were that he put out over the years, and they're all great. The humor is amazing, and of course, you can read about him in my book, too.
Okay. Well, thanks, Ray. He also says, even as we speak, the culture wars are raging while more sputtering on the Berkeley campus over the choice of Bill Maher as the commencement speaker.
That's true.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, thanks for that. Let's go next to Pat in San Francisco. Hi, Pat. Welcome to the show.
Yes. Good morning. I don't accept the premise of multi-races. We are one human race, and within that, we have subsets of ethnicity and cultures.
Would you say that people have been discriminated against because of their backgrounds in the past?
Yes. I'm 63 years old. I've lived through those times of the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
And I've learned that we're all part of one race, the human race, and we need to look beyond our cultural or ethnic differences to see that in each other.
Do you enjoy Chinese food?
Yes. In fact, I lived in Asia for a number of years.
Oh, that's good. Yeah. This is the thing. Like, I think that when you get to the specifics of that, I think it's a beautiful and a wonderful ideal, and I think Martin Luther King Jr. was asking for us to be able to reach that point. And it's certainly the kind of colorblindness that every first grader and second grader in school gets taught about. The reality is that we all come from someplace, and that we have families and histories that we belong to. As somebody who whose food by definition is always Chinese, because anything I make is going to be food that's by Chinese Hawaiian. I'm always happy to share that with other folks, and I like it when they enjoy it. And I wouldn't like them to ignore that I was taught some of that stuff by my mom and my dad and my grandparents and that kind of thing. And at the same time, I wouldn't want anybody to forget that in the past, folks who look like me have been mistreated because of who they are. So it's dealing with both of the things at the same time, I think, that I would hope that we get to.
Thank you for calling, Pat. I believe we have a similar call from Mark in Monterey. Hi, Mark.
Hello. You've been doing the whole program mixing up race, culture, and ethnicity. You've never tried to define the word race. And the reason you haven't is because you probably can't. And I would like to hear a little discussion on what the term means. And try not to mix up, please, biological and social definition.
Mark, what do you think it means?
I don't think it exists in a biological sense. It's technical, and not the time to go into it here, but there never was such a thing as race. There is such a thing as crimes. Gradual change in single genetic traits over space for adaptation purposes. Race is a misnomer that started from the time of Linnaeus. The only reality in the biological world is species. Everything below species is subspecies or race or whatever you want to call it, is a man-made, human-made conception. And it simply does not exist. And
All right, let me get Jeff's comment because we're almost out of time.
Yeah, I agree. There's no such biological thing as race, and there's absolutely at the same time been a social construct that folks have used to divide and separate and rank. You know, certainly through the last, you know, 3, 4, 5 centuries of humankind. And so, you know, I appreciate the sentiment. What I think I'm trying to get at here is that these are discussions that have to happen in the space, in the cultural space, in order for us to be able to move forward.
All right. Thank you for the call. We've got about a minute left, Jeff. Mm-hmm. Final thoughts on this issue? I mean, you've been giving a lot of talks. You're kind of in the middle of your book tour. What's really coming up in these dialogues?
What's come up is the need for the dialogue.
Yeah.
I think I've been really surprised, actually, about, you know, the passion that folks have brought to these kinds of conversations. Every time we've done an event or had sort of call-in radio like here with you, Rose, it's been an amazing, mind-blowing kind of discussion.
That surprised you?
It surprised me, honestly, because, you know, I think in the media, what we see is these sort of knee-jerk reactions, like a celebrity says something crazy and we run them off, you know, within 36 hours, and we don't have these deep conversations. So I'm thankful that we're able to actually do that.
Jeff Chang is author of Who We Be, The Colorization of America. You can find his speaking events November 10th, First Congregational Church in Oakland at 7:30, November 11th, City College Chinatown Campus in San Francisco at 7. Jeff, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. And thanks for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. What is revolutionary today? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation with the Black Panthers co-founder Bobby Seale and the artistic director of Party People, a new play at Berkeley Rep. Party People reflects on the history of the Black Panther Party and the Young Lords, a Puerto Rican immigrants' rights movement that called for independence. So what can we learn from their radical histories, and what is considered a revolutionary act today? Join the conversation on the next Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Becca Hoekstra produces the show. Malihe Razazan is senior producer, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org. Work.